The following content is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, enjoy articles to help you improve your green thumb. And now, here's NCRS volunteer Cindy Fowler.
This article is by Lisa Boone. Six ways to help tomato plants withstand the heat. Tomatoes can thrive in full sun, but can soaring temperatures be too much of a good thing? We turned to Tomatomania's Scott Daigre, author of the book Tomatomania, a fresh approach to celebrating tomatoes in the garden and in the kitchen, who says 6 to 8 hours of sun a day are all a tomato plant needs, so shade accordingly. Here, Daigre offers tips on how to keep your tomatoes going strong during the hot summer months. 1. Shade. The plant needs shade for developing fruit. Try to take the heat off from noon to 4 p.m. They need sun. They just do not need sun all day in 105 degrees. Be creative. I wrapped some of my container plants like an ice cream cone. I used a row cover to drape over my tomato cages. Row cover is very light and primarily protects against birds. You can water through it. Some people are using umbrellas. One of my readers told me he put up a wire structure and layered it with palm fronds. It was a South Seas island shelter. 2. Water deeply. The goal is to soak the root ball. Soak the plant well in the morning, and then don't water it for a few days. The key is to make sure you are giving the plant abundant water every few days, rather than a little bit of water every day. 3. Remove colored fruit early. Don't expect too much from your plants. Grab fruit early if it is colored. You may not want to wait for it to ripen when temperatures are expected to soar. If you are picking early, clip the tomatoes and put them on a cool kitchen counter for a while. It will eventually ripen and taste great. 4. Mulch. Mulch, mulch, mulch. The more you mulch, the more you can shield the soil from the hot breeze. I use straw all the time, which is available at any feed store. Put an inch of compost underneath it to feed the soil. That way, you protect the upper layer and cool the soil. 5. Container plants. Container plants are taking the biggest hit because you cannot deep water them in a pot. You have to water the plant every day, twice a day perhaps, in heat like this. 6. Looking ahead. The heat wave is one of the reasons I recommend planting north to south rows. That way, the plants get exposure to the sun, but not all day long. Our next article is by Norman Winter. Sombrero coneflowers ablaze in dazzling colors. Something wonderful has happened in the world of purple coneflowers, flowers. And that is science to the point it would probably even impress an astrophysicist. The science here, however, is with the selections, the breeding, crosses, and back crosses. Stuff that makes a rusty horticulturalist like myself amazed and a little envious that I wasn't part of the project. The result is our native coneflower species have simply gotten better. More color, flowers, and habits to include in your garden. Your designs will be more intriguing, colorful, and all the while bringing in so many pollinators, it will appear it was specifically done at their behest. It was just a few years ago that I wrote about the Sombrero series that was developed by Darwin Perennials, a Ball horticultural company. At the time, I raved about Sombrero Hot Coral, part of a series of four. Today, there are a dozen colors, and if you ever get to see a garden center or nursery growing all of them, you will not only want one of each, but you will lose all rationale and want the whole inventory. I thought Sombrero Hot Coral was my favorite, but the orange selections, like Sombrero Adobe Orange and Sombrero Flamenco Orange, have a color that I just can't pass up. Partnered with blue, like the new Misty Salvia, or even the soft blue of Russian Sage, creates a partnership that I just can't have enough. Terra Novi Nurseries, another innovative leader in perennial plant breeding, introduced us all to the Prima series this year. Prima comes in cinnamon, ruby, and an artistic designer-looking ginger. Although compact in habit, the flower quantity is most impressive. I loved watching bees in what seemed to be a pollen ecstasy. Early spring is still my favorite time to plant cone flowers. Select healthy growing transplants not yet in flower. These are the ones that are still producing roots and green leaves. But to be honest, the industry has changed, offering us healthy, blooming, vibrant transplants all season. Last fall, when I was at the Coastal Georgia Botanical Gardens in Savannah, we had the opportunity to plant these blooming echinaceas in September. As crazy and as scientifically wrong that it felt, I can truthfully say, it worked, and they were great. Go figure. So, should you live in an area that has a nursery offering fresh blooming coneflowers in early September, don't be afraid. You have not lost your mind. Whatever you decide to plant, choose a site in full sun for the best flower performance. The soil need not be luxuriantly fertile. On the other hand, if it takes a pickaxe or jackhammer to break apart, plan on incorporating 3 to 4 inches of organic matter. While tilling, go ahead and work in 2 pounds of a slow-release 12-6-6 fertilizer per 100 square feet of bed space. Space your plants 8 to 14 inches apart in an informal drift or sweep. If you have the mucky soil, consider planting on raised beds using a prepared landscape mix. Your partnership opportunities with these new echinaceas are unlimited. Some of the prettiest beds I've seen this year had them partnered with multicolored coreopsis and blue salvias. You'll love them in informal sweeps or drifts with rudbeckias or gloriosa daisies like Prairie Sun or Indian Summer. They also look so natural in a prairie-like companion with ornamental grasses swaying in the breeze. Purple coneflowers still come in purple, and they will always be recommended. Keep your eyes open, however, for the new multicolored Sombrero and Prima series, as well as Cheyenne Spirit, an All-American Selections winner from 2013. Now from the National Gardening Association e-newsletter. The Little Bulbs by Ellen Seiko. Fall is bulb planting season, and while many gardeners focus on the showy blooms of tulips and daffodils, I have a personal preference for what people call the little bulbs. Some people call them minor bulbs, but that doesn't seem fair, considering how lovely and low maintenance they are. These petite, unusual bulbs are not always found in garden stores, so you may need to mail order them. Generally, bulbs should be planted 3 times as deep as they are tall. That's another reason to appreciate the little bulbs, which are no more than a half inch to 1 inch in diameter. Digging 2 inches into rocky or heavy clay soil is a lot easier than digging the 6 inches required for some jumbo bulbs. But I don't just love them because I'm a lazy gardener. The little bulbs look so natural and appealing in the garden, especially when planted in large sweeps. If you'd like to plant something a little more unusual this year, consider these little bulbs that are small in size, but big in garden impact. Winter aconite has a unique form. A bright yellow blossom sits perched on a ruffled collar of foliage. It's one of the earliest bulbs to flower and often blooms through snow. Hardy to zone 3, winter aconites grow well in part to full sun and are deer resistant. Plants are 3 to 6 inches tall. Snowdrop also often blooms before the snow has melted, bringing hope and encouragement to the heart of every winter-weary gardener. Delicate white flowers, marked with green at the neck, dangle from 10-inch tall plants. There are many cultivars available, including double-flowered forms and giant snowdrops that bloom even earlier than common snowdrops. Most grow best in part shade and are deer-resistant. Siberian squill is hardy to zone 2 and is one of the most shade-tolerant bulbs. It is also deer-resistant. Blooms start out as hanging bell shapes and open wide as they mature. The cultivar Spring Beauty has especially bright blue blooms, while Alba has lovely white flowers. Plants are 3 to 6 inches tall, and flowers open after those of snowdrops and winter aconite. Glory of the Snow are hardy to zone 4 and come in many different colors. Violet Beauty has pale purple blooms with white centers. C. sardensis produces bright purple/blue flowers, and the flowers of Pink Giant are the faintest pastel pink. Plants grow to be 4 to 6 inches tall and are happiest in full sun. Checkered Lily is delicate, with tulip-shaped flowers that hang facing downward. The petals are marked with a checkered pattern in shades of purple. The cultivar Alba is less common and has white flowers. Checkered Lily is hardy to zone 4 and grows best in part shade and moist soil. For a naturalized effect, scatter a handful of little bulbs on the lawn and plant them where they land. It's quick work with a sharp trowel. You'll be in for a treat come spring when a lovely swath of bloom appears as if by magic. Bulb foliage should be left to yellow on the plant, sending as much energy as possible back to the bulb for next year's flowers. Since the leaves of the little bulbs are smaller than those of the larger bulbs, they won't look quite as messy as they yellow. Resist temptation to braid the foliage or loop it neatly with elastic bands. The leaf surface needs to be exposed to the sun in order to photosynthesize and store food to support next year's blooms. If you plan to naturalize bulbs in a lawn area, keep in mind that you will need to forego mowing until the bulb foliage has died back. Yes, you'll have to tolerate a little natural messiness in the garden, but it's worth it. The rewards of these little bulbs is great indeed. Now from Dave's Garden e-newsletter. Now, I'm no botanist, but I do know that if you put water on plants, they grow. Said by Joe, Idiocracy. Digging Up Your Tender Bulbs and Tubers by Laura Foreman. Want to enjoy your beautiful dahlias and begonias next year? Try storing them inside over the winter. The autumn is not only harvest time, it's also a good time to prepare your garden for next year. Part of that process involves digging up your tender tubers, corms, and bulbs to protect them from freezing temperatures and inclement weather. Even if you live in an area that does not normally experience freezing temperatures, but does see an increase in rainfall, it's still a good idea to dig them up to ensure they don't rot underground. So exactly when should you dig up your dahlias, gladiolas, and begonias? And what is the best way to do so without damaging them? Tubers. Protect your tuberous plants like dahlias, tuberose, and tuberous begonias from the elements by digging them up after the first frost of autumn. If you grow tuberous plants in pots, your job is easy. Just bring the containers in the house and store them in a cool, dry area for the season. Many tuberous plants are touted to be hardy to zone 9 and will usually go dormant, turn yellow, and drop their leaves and greenery. Still, digging them up will prevent them from rotting in the ground over the winter. Those in zones 8 and below will want to dig their tubers up following the first frost of the fall. Although it's best to wait a week or so after the frost, light frosts are often followed by hard ones. Once your area experiences a light frost, pay attention to the weather forecast. If a hard frost is expected, get them out of the ground to prevent potential damage. When digging up your tubers, be careful not to damage them. Use a pitchfork or spade to loosen the soil and begin digging in the dirt about a foot from the stem of each plant. Once the tubers are in sight, carefully pull them out of the ground and use your fingers to brush the dirt from them. If the leaves and stems have been damaged by frost, trim the affected bits, but leave the greenery if it's still fine. Clean your tubers by filling a tub or sink with water, or shower them with a garden hose. Be careful not to damage their skins. Take time to inspect each tuber and trim away any areas of rot. Before you cut, sterilize your tools by heating their blades and letting them cool. Many gardeners also divide their tubers at this time, but this is a task that can wait till spring. Let the tubers dry for a few weeks in an area with great air circulation out of direct sunlight. Once dried, remove the stems. Then apply an antifungal powder like sulfur dust to them to prevent the spread of rot. Wear gloves, a face mask, and other protective gear when doing this. To store the tubers, line a box with newspaper and fill it with peat moss, coarse sand, wood shavings, sawdust, or vermiculite. You'll want to place the tubers or label the tubers so you know exactly what you're planting next year. Write on the tubers themselves or place them in paper bags. Wrap them in newspaper and label that instead. Spritz your storage medium with water to prevent the tubers from drying out and place them in the box. Over the winter, you'll want to periodically inspect your tubers and throw away any that are rotted or mushy. If you find that they're drying out, spritz the storage medium again. Corms, such as gladiolas and freesia, should also be dug up after the first frost. However, you can also choose to dig them up once they're done flowering and their foliage has turned brown, as long as it's within the 8-week period before your area typically gets its first frost of the year. Digging up corms in the fall is similar to that of digging up tubers. Using a pitchfork or spade, start digging about a foot away from each corm. Gently pull them up and carefully remove the dirt from them. Unlike tubers, you can let the corms cure by placing them on top of the soil to dry for a few days. However, if rain or frost is in the forecast, dry them in an indoor area with good air circulation instead. Once the corms are dry, separate the old ones from the new ones with cormlets on them. Many gardeners throw away the old corms. Remove dead foliage and brush away any excess dirt. Throw away any corms that are soft or beginning to rot, and dust the remaining corms with an antifungal powder. Layer them in a box, placing newspaper between each layer. You can also hang them in a breathable produce bag or even nylon pantyhose. Place the box or hang the bag in a cool, dry area that stays around 40 degrees Fahrenheit, such as the garage or in the refrigerator's vegetable bin. Bulbs. Spring-planted bulbs can be dug up once their foliage turns brown and they go into dormancy, or when the first frost occurs, whichever happens first. If you're not sure, try tugging at the brown foliage. If it breaks off easily, the bulb is probably dormant. Again, dig about a foot away from each bulb using a spade or trowel. Dig under the bulbs and lift them from the ground. Once you've pulled out the bulbs, brush the dirt off of them and look for signs of damage or rot. If a bulb has soft spots, signs of rot, or otherwise has been damaged, throw it away. This is also a great time to divide your bulbs and twist them free of one another. Dry your bulbs for about a week and remove any remaining foliage from them. Dust them with an antifungal powder, place them in paper bags. Put the bags in a box filled with peat moss, vermiculite, or another storage medium, and store the box in a cool, dry place where the temperature remains between 60 and 65 degrees Fahrenheit. And check on them over the winter months, looking for rot and throw away any that show signs of disease. With a bit of head care, you'll be able to put some perfectly healthy plants in the ground come springtime. This article is by Norman Winter, titled Vermilionaire Cuppia, a must-have plant for birds and butterflies. 3 years ago, I wrote an article on cuppias and merely gave casual mention to a variety called Vermilionaire, which we have been growing for a year. Now, after growing 3 more years, including 7 at my home on a rocky red clay hillside in West Georgia, I can say this is a must-have plant. When I say must-have, you may be thinking that is a pretty strong recommendation. Now, in late July, my plants are about 24 inches tall, 36 inches wide. The orange-red tubular flowers are non-stop and produced by the hundreds on each plant. There are always 5 or 6 hummingbirds on them, leaving occasionally to go hit on my giant Amistad salvia. The bees are there in great numbers, too, and every once in a while appear to challenge a hummingbird. This usually ends up with the hummer quickly showing who's boss. The thing that has surprised me most, however, are the butterflies. Every day there are spicebush swallowtails, eastern tiger swallowtails, and even pearl crescents. This is truly a plant for anyone that enjoys the pollinator garden. I have mine intermingle with milkweeds and the new misty blue salvia. The combination has been very pleasing and really successful. My son, who I sometimes consider the adventurous color designer, uses them in large containers with lime green ornamental sweet potato vines and even calabacas. He uses them at outdoor shopping centers where the clientele is often stunned at seeing hummingbirds at the mall. Botanically speaking, Vermilionaire is a Cuppia ignea hybrid. It develops into a woody-like plant, and as I said, bearing hundreds of scarlet orange flowers for months. in zones 8 and 9, it will get knocked to the ground by freezes, but normally returns faithfully in the spring, provided it does not sit in water during the cold winter. Believe me, it is being grown in colder areas as an annual, much like you would a petunia. When you locate your vermilionaire cupius, buy at least 3. Select a site in full sun and plant in well-drained soil. Set plants 24 to 36 inches apart, planting at the same depth they are growing in the container. Apply a good layer of mulch, water to get established, and then enjoy. In early summer, pinch growth as needed, and more branching will follow. My son does this religiously, while I have a tendency to leave them natural. Both methods have proven very successful. Feed in midsummer and again in early fall with a light application of a balanced, slow-release fertilizer. These species are drought-tolerant, but watering during prolonged dry periods will pay dividends in the fall. Use them informally in the garden rather than lined up like soldiers. They work well with other hummingbird plants, like the firebush, or planted in partnership with Chapel Hill yellow lantana and gold star esperanza. Blue flowers, whether round or spiky, create partnerships that you will want to photograph as much as the hummingbirds. A lot of hot weather remains, and vermilionaire cupius would make a fine addition to your garden. And now, from Dave's Garden e-newsletter, Tomato History and Hearsay by Audrey Stahlsmith. Where did the tomato come from? Although few of us today can imagine a world without tomatoes, Solanum lycopersicum. Those fruits didn't become a staple of the American diet until the end of the 19th century. During the Civil War, there had been a large demand for canned victuals to feed the soldiers, and tomatoes fit right into those tins. By the conclusion of the 1800s, the fruit had become popular enough that a certain Campbell sold it as soup. However, the tomato had not gained its acceptance easily. It probably originated in the mountains of western South America, only to be ignored by the natives there. At some point, the plant was carried north to Central America and Mexico, where the Aztecs recognized its potential.
That's all the time we have for today. You've been listening to Out in the Garden on the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast by visiting our website at ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, give us a call. Our telephone number is 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.